I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. A grim anniversary. Last week marked 5 years of conflict in Syria. Nearly half its population has been displaced, around 11 million people. Some have fled to other parts of the Middle East or to Europe. Many more have relocated within Syria. Nearly all require humanitarian aid. And despite peace talks and a shaky ceasefire, the conflict seems unlikely to end anytime soon. Starting yesterday, the European Union announced it would send nearly all migrants arriving in Greece back to Turkey. What is the situation like on the ground, and how is the global community responding to the largest humanitarian crisis since World War II? That's Midday, right after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm glad you're with us. It has been 5 years since the start of the war in Syria. Unmediated peace talks resumed last week, and a tenuous ceasefire has been in place since the end of February. Meanwhile, the humanitarian crisis continues to grow. To date, 11 million Syrians, nearly twice the population of Maryland, have fled their homes. Today, we're talking about what the conflict has done to those who have left the country as well as those who remain. Over the weekend, a major development in the refugee crisis, the European Union put a new rule into effect. Any migrants to Greece will be sent back to Turkey if their asylum claim is rejected. The EU has made a deal with Turkey. In exchange for financial aid and political concessions, Turkey will become a holding ground for refugees. For each migrant returned to Turkey, a Syrian already there will be resettled in the EU. For now, the EU says it will accept no more than 72,000 Syrians. To put that number in perspective, more than a million migrants entered the EU by boat from Turkey to Greece in the last year. And as spring approaches, the flood of migrants is likely to increase. What will the EU's deal with Turkey mean for migrants? How are host countries coping? What is the daily reality for Syrians at home and abroad? Two guests have joined me in the studio to help answer these questions. Mark Ohanian is director of programs at the International Orthodox Christian Charities, IOCC, a humanitarian organization based in Baltimore, one of the largest networks providing aid within Syria. Mark, welcome back to Midday.
Thank you, Sheila. Pleasure being here.
And also with us, Bill O'Keefe, Vice President of Government Relations and Advocacy for Catholic Relief Services, also headquartered in Baltimore. CRS has played a key role in supporting refugees from Syria throughout the conflict. Bill, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Sheila. It's a pleasure.
So I want to start with this deal between the European Union and Turkey that took effect yesterday. I'd like to get your reactions. As I understand it, most migrants who arrive in Greece will now be sent back to Turkey. Bill, what is your understanding of how this will work?
My understanding of how it works is that once they have systems in place, they will be sending back refugees who arrive on Greek islands back to Turkey. And there they will apply for asylum should they choose. And as you mentioned in the introduction, for each refugee who's returned from Greece, the EU is going to accept through a more orderly process that doesn't involve this extremely dangerous water crossing a refugee for resettlement in the EU. Only 72,000 people are going to get that offer, which is much less than the million or so from last year. And certainly that is a huge concern. As long as the war continues, people are going to want to flee. But that's how we understand it's going to work. There's some things that still need to be done to put it in place. For example, the EU has committed to send a group of experts to Turkey to help assist in the processing of refugees, and also to Greece to help assist. And those folks are not yet on the ground. What we understand from our team on the island of Lesbos is that there's a lot of confusion, and refugees are still grappling with what this new new set of procedures will mean for them.
The news coverage I read uses the phrase, I think, irregular migrants to describe the people who would not make it through the screening process to be resettled in Europe. What can either of you tell me what an irregular migrant is? You're both nodding.
Yeah. Like. Well, I think an irregular migrant in this case means anyone who does not meet the international definition of a refugee, who has and can prove cause to be fleeing political or other oppression in their country of origin. And so irregular migrants, I think, means all those who are judged at least to be fleeing for economic reasons, to seek a better life. Those people could be from any number of other countries in addition to Syria. Remember that of the million or so who came to Europe last year, about half were Syrians, and then the rest were mainly Afghans and Iraqis, and then people from a bunch of other countries as well.
And as I read about this deal being negotiated and the news coverage leading up to it, there was great stress on the idea that everyone seeking asylum, making an asylum claim, would get a hearing. And I'm trying to picture the situation. Is that realistic that that's actually going to happen in the with the I read this morning that 1,600 people migrants arrived in Greece just yesterday, the first day of this alleged new regime. I mean, is it realistic that people who have a claim for asylum are actually going to be able to articulate it and get a fair hearing?
I think Bill mentioned earlier that they're trying to figure the procedures out right now on the islands for the incoming refugees. And you're absolutely right, Sheila. There's on average somewhere between 1,000 to 1,500 migrants arriving every day. And that's been the case for the refugees arriving.
Yesterday was not a special day. It was
a typical flow, exactly. So, and that's what the European Union is trying to curb or change by introducing this new regulation right now. And what we worry will happen is, first of all, the Greek authorities right now are moving all the migrants from the islands into the mainland, so that any migrant arriving to the islands going forward, starting today, they will be processed. And this process right now, that is still not clear to us, which is what Bill was mentioning as well earlier, we need to figure out how that process will work, the determination of whether you're eligible to go to continue and seek asylum in Europe or to be sent back to Turkey. We need to figure that out, how that works. But what we suspect will happen, a good number of those refugees coming to the islands will be sent back to Turkey. That's the concern that exists. So right now, approximately 47,000 migrants or refugees are in Greece today. And with these numbers of 1,050 or somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 arriving every day, that remains to be a concern. And another concern is they will be put, the refugees, what we're hearing, and it remains to be seen, of course, into those centers, the hotspots, that will be operated more like a detention centers managed by the army, by the Greek army. So again, this is what we're hearing, but we will wait and see how that will pan out. Bottom line, I think at the end of the day, this is a deal that is good for Europe. The question is it good for the refugees? And right now, Europe and Turkey, they have come up with this deal. It seems they're moving forward with it. It's good for them. It's good for the European bloc. It's good for Turkey. Turkey is getting or about to get somewhere close to 6 billion euros, if I'm not mistaken, and that's being negotiated, and along with other perks such as accelerated negotiation into the EU or visa-free entry for the Turkish citizen into European Union and so forth. But what's going to happen to the refugees? I mean, that's the key question that remains. What are we doing as European Union and other countries to support those refugees who are really, many of them, more than half of them, are actually fleeing for good, solid reasons of persecution, of hardship, and so forth. They're not just the average economic migrant, let's say, that's coming from Afghanistan or other countries. We have 60% of the migrants in Greece. They're Syrian refugees. So that remains to be the big question, I think, for us.
That is Mark Ohanian, Director of Programs at International Orthodox Christian Charities, IOCC. Here on Midday on WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. Also here with me is Bill O'Keefe, Vice President of Government Relations and Advocacy for Catholic Relief Services. What do you think of the European Union's new deal with Turkey? Share your thoughts. You can be part of this conversation. Send us an email to midday@wypr.org or call us at 410-662-8780. Before we go any further, I should actually ask each of you to tell listeners, both of you have been in the region we're talking about relatively recently, and if you could each share with our listeners what you do and where you, when you were there most recently and what you saw there. Bill O'Keefe from CRS, tell
us. Sure, thanks. I, in December, had the opportunity to go to Greece and Macedonia and Serbia and follow the pipeline that refugees at the time were taking on their way to Germany from Turkey. And it was a great trip in the sense of I really understood, I think at a much deeper level, how big of an issue this really is. And the sense of the flow of humanity of 5,000 or 6,000 people a day at the time, kind of flowing northward, fleeing violence and looking for a better life. And it just was an overwhelming experience in a lot of ways. And I've been to a lot of refugee situations, and but I can tell you it was quite an overwhelming experience. I was quite hearkened by the amazing work of local nonprofits, faith-based and otherwise, in Serbia and Macedonia and in Greece, that were really trying to ramp up from being small kind of social work organizations into these much larger refugee provision groups. And Catholic Relief Services and other groups were helping in that process. Really challenging, but always great to see good people trying to help others locally, and that was really really encouraging.
Can you describe in a simple way what Catholic Relief Services is mostly doing in
sure.
the region?
So what we're doing is at each of the points of this pipeline, where at a border crossing people were getting off of a train or getting onto a train or getting off of a bus, we're providing food, clothing, medical care, and then the important service of translation and information. And I can't overestimate the importance of this, because you have people who are finding themselves in a completely new society, who don't understand the language, who are getting messages from smugglers and from people who don't have their best interest in mind, and to be met by a local group with a translator who speaks their language and tells them honestly, here's what you need to know about the pipe, the path that is ahead of you. And here are the services that we can provide and that others can provide. So we're providing that basket of services through our local partners all the way along the way from Greece and on the way up. Now, that pipeline now has gaps along the way. They've pretty much all the Balkan states have closed their borders more or less. And now we have some people who are stuck in each of those countries who we're providing those same services to. But that's what I saw, and I met incredible people and have some great stories I'd be happy to share later.
Yeah, I hope we do get back into it. Mark Ohanian, am I right that International Orthodox Christian Charities, which is an effort by the Orthodox bishops in the United States to help worldwide, that in this case your work is more focused inside Syria?
Correct. We've been working inside Syria since 2002, and with following the Iraq invasion, we started working as well, supporting there the Iraqi refugees who came into Syria since 2007. And with the onset of the conflict in Syria, the war in Syria, the nature of our operation changed significantly since 2012. So, yes, we have an extensive presence in Syria via the Antiochian Orthodox Church, which is our partner in the country. We have presence in 10 governorates out of the 14, the Syrian governorates. And they mostly are the coastal areas of Syria, Aleppo, Hasakeh in the northeast, Hasakeh and Kamishli in the northeast, all the way down to Damascus, Homs, Damascus, Suwaida and Daraa governorates in the south on the border with Jordan. So it's a widespread presence with around 28 offices across those 10 governorates. But we're also working, obviously, just like CRS, my colleague Bill, in Lebanon and also in Jordan in meeting the needs of the refugees in those countries.
And real briefly, we're just about to take a quick break, but you were most recently in the area yourself.
I was in Syria and Lebanon in January, this January. I was actually in Lebanon just 2 weeks ago as well. So, yes, I do go frequently there in support of our operations, and I'm happy to talk about that as well. Maybe it's
I think our listeners do want to hear for what you both saw firsthand. As I said, we're going to take a quick break here, and when we come back, more on how Syrians are coping after 5 years of conflict. How do you think the international community should respond to this humanitarian crisis? You can join the conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Kast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Kast. We're talking today about the plight of Syrians, those who have fled their country as well as those who remain. With me are two men who are intimately familiar with this crisis, Bill O'Keefe, Vice President of Government Relations and Advocacy for Catholic Relief Services, and Mark Ohanian, Director of Programs for the International Orthodox Christian Charities, IOCC. Both CRS and IOCC are headquartered in Baltimore. Something like 2,000 Syrians drowned in the Mediterranean last year en route to Europe. I read this morning that four people drowned yesterday trying to get into Greece, including two babies. And that Greek officials are saying this new deal, this regime can't really work unless Europe stops the smugglers. And I think Europe's attitude has been that the deal should dry up the market for the smugglers. I mean, what effect do you think this change right now will have on people setting out from Syria in particular on the sea?
Well, let me address that question for starters, and then I know Mark will have a lot to add as well. We have already seen an increase in smuggling. And the first impact...
An increase since...
In anticipation of this deal, an increase in smuggling. And as the Balkan countries have sort of closed down their different borders, it's resulted in an increase in smuggling. It's resulted in a decrease in movement in total, so that you may get its way in that way, but an increase in smuggling. And I think that's one of our main concerns about this deal, is that... You know, we hope it works. It's good to have a more orderly system. The sort of failure of the EU at the beginning of the crisis to come together and deal with this this huge population flow together in an orderly way really led to this massive migration in a kind of an uncontrolled way. And so we hope that this system will bring some order. But there are two consequences we're concerned about. One is increase in smugglers. And the second is, in the last couple of months, we've seen a change in the demography of the refugees who have been moving north. At the beginning, 6 months ago, 3 months ago in the fall, it was mainly young men, or not mainly, but a higher percentage. And it's very natural. Families send their able-bodied young men to go and scope out the situation and try to find a house and see if they can get somewhere, and then they bring their families along later. Now the men are already there, and now it's the women and children who are stuck behind. And so we have a situation, if this freezes movement in time, where you have a bunch of men who are up in Europe and then their families are back in Turkey. And that's a very serious concern. Family reunification is always one of our principal concerns in this kind of situation.
Mark, when I think of the dangers and so much attention, at least in the Western press, has been given to the dangers of setting out on the sea, I think anyone who does it must be truly desperate. I mean, what do you see from from your contacts inside Syria as to why people make the journey?
There's no doubt that there's an unbelievable amount of desperation in the Syrians. This is for people, whether they're refugees in Lebanon or Jordan or IDPs or even host Syrians.
IDPs, internally displaced persons.
Internally displaced persons, those who left, for instance, Aleppo or Hasaki area and they chose a relatively safer area going to Latakia or Tartus or Damascus or other parts of the country. The desperation is probably the key thing that you see whenever I meet any Syrian, wherever they are in Syria. It's not knowing what's happening next. Syrians are confused. They don't know what the future holds for them. They look around the conflict. They look around. They look at the situation, the political developments of the peace process. The light is not so bright, even though there's a small hope that there is at least a political process in place. But the prospects don't seem very promising at this point. And with that comes the confusion also with the Syrians. Okay, what do we do next? We have families here that have fled the violence from various parts of the country with their children. Just a specific example, a head of household from Aleppo who had his own factory, producing garments in Aleppo, who lost all of his work, who lost his factory, who lost his equipment, which is the main capital that he had. And he is right now in the rural homes area with his family, with three children and wife. He's renting. He's paying about $250 for rent for a small place, and he doesn't have a job. He's actually thinking of opening a juice store, a store to make juice, so that he can get by to cover his rent. So they've lost their dignity to start with, and of course.
Are they at risk? Does he feel at risk there in homes?
Of where they are, for the moment, they are not at risk. But the dynamics of the conflict can change any moment because there's no place in Syria today that is absolute security as such. Because the warring party, the pressure can come from either of the groups, be it from the rebel groups, be it from the government groups or whatever that is. And the dynamics can change on the ground. It has been so fluid for us since 2012 in terms of who controls territory and what territory is controlled by who. It doesn't give you or the people of Syria the stability to kind of plan for the long term. And also the majority of the families that I've met, actually, especially those who have young girls and boys, 15, 16, 18, and 20 years old, they all want to move. In fact, they're putting money aside. They're borrowing money so that they make that treacherous journey to go to Turkey and from Turkey to Europe. And that's because they do not see any hope for themselves staying in that country. And at least the parents, the way parents think, as much as they don't want their kids to leave Syria, they don't want their kids to leave their home, they just can't stop them from being there because they don't have any prospect of continuing their education or having some sort of normal living standards in those places.
Demetrius is calling us from Catonsville with a comment about the Turkish EU deal. Demetrius, welcome to Midday.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine.
I just want to say I think it's been established that the migrants from Syria, Iraq, and everywhere else aren't really the problem. It just seems EU is trading with Turkey these migrants like there's some kind of spice, and what they're getting in return is this false sense of security, and on top of that, Turkey's gaining everything. They're getting billions of dollars, potential access into the EU, and with zero acknowledgement of any past atrocities that they've done to numerous populations, and I don't see the benefit. Yet again, the people of Greece and Cyprus are being slapped in the face and treated like second-tier EU citizens.
Demetrius, I appreciate your call. I must say, it has struck me the other way, thinking of how many refugees are quite likely, or migrants are quite likely to stay in Turkey, since only 72,000 are being promised some way of getting on to Europe. But I'd love to know what Mark or Bill think about your comment. Thanks for calling, Demetrius.
I think Demetrius is right on. I think this deal is good for the EU. It's good for Turkey, if you look at it, for a number of reasons. Again, the question remains, is it good for the refugee and migrant population? From one side, I think the EU did promise an increase of assistance in the what they call the root causes of the conflict, meaning assistance for inside Syria and Lebanon and Jordan. And I think they're doing good work on that, but again, that remains to be seen. Yes, the EU does seem to be primarily motivated by the fact that they want to take control of this migrant flow, because it is posing serious challenge for a number of EU countries, including the entire unity of the European Union. I guess there has been number of calls around the subject. So again, we still need to see on how will this be translated into a concrete help for the refugees, because at the end of the day, if EU only processes the magic number of 72,000 refugees, then what happens with the other hundreds of thousands and millions of refugees and IDPs, the displaced persons that are not moving elsewhere? That remains the key question. What are we doing about that?
I would just add, what I really liked about what the caller had to say is that the migrants are not the problem. And I think that is the right frame to look at this. The EU has the capacity and the U.S. has the capacity to help more than it already is, to take many more of these refugees if it organized itself and had a fair burden-sharing agreement. And in a way, what they've done, rather than have a burden-sharing agreement amongst all the countries, they've outsourced to Turkey the responsibility. And then and Turkey's getting something in return, and whether that's a good deal for them, who knows? It's certainly outside of my expertise, but there are 350 million people in the European Union or so, and a million refugees is something that is doable, and it's at the level of the kinds of refugee responses in Vietnamese Americans, for example, that we've done. And we can do a lot more here in the United States as well. We've taken 1,300 Syrians this year, something like that, and that's not too many.
Yeah, I want to ask you more about that. First, let me just say this is Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Bill O'Keefe, Vice President of Government Relations and Advocacy for Catholic Relief Services. CRS works in many of the countries affected by the refugee crisis. And with Mark Ohanian, Director of Programs for International Orthodox Christian Charities, IOCC. He oversees 400 staff people on the ground in the Middle East, including 28 satellite offices within Syria. Both have recently traveled to the region. What would you like to know about what they encountered when they were there? Join our conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email to midday@wypr.org. Jason has called us from Baltimore. Jason, welcome to Midday.
Hello?
Jason, yes, you're on the air.
Hey there. I just wanted to make a quick correction to the vocabulary using. I prefer to call the Syrian refugees to be invaders.
You call the Syrian refugees invaders?
Yes, ma'am.
Can you explain that briefly and then let me get a reaction from my guests?
Well, ma'am, I refer to them as invaders because they are currently trying to...
Yes.
Hold on, I'm sorry, the call is cutting out. Never mind, man.
Jason? Okay, I'm not sure we need to continue to discuss that. I'm curious about, Mark, in Syria, are schools continuing to operate?
In some capacity. Let's not forget that I cannot just not comment on what we just heard. We need to keep in mind that the great majority, if not all of the Syrians that are leaving their country, they're doing so because they're forced to leave. I have not met any Syrian that does not want to go back to their own country if the conditions are right. So they're really not into going into Europe and leaving their families and their villages and their towns that they come with. And Syrians are very proud people as well. And if they had the choice, if they had the right conditions, they would not leave their country. And I think that's where I think we need to keep in mind. So the choice of words, maybe we may disagree on that, on what we've heard, but I think it's important to make to make that note. So.
Well, then let me put aside for a minute my question about schools. I do want us to talk about young people and their education. But Bill mentioned a few minutes ago the United States could do more. My impression is that many Syrians have wanted not to move even though they felt not safe in Syria, wanted to stay in the region because they did hope to return to Syria. That seems to have frayed in the last, what, year and a half. You would know better than I. Now there seems to be much more of an intensity among more Syrians to get away from Syria some distance. But Bill O'Keefe, does it make sense for the United States to play a bigger role? Because once somebody comes here to resettle, the chances of them ever returning to Syria seem pretty slim. Far away.
No, we are far away. And that's one of the reasons why we can have such a controlled and well-vetted refugee system, is because we are far away. And so what we can do is take more of the most vulnerable Syrians who really, under any circumstance, because of what they've experienced, are not going to be going back and are not going to be able to go back and not be safe going back. And there's a lot of room for us to take more. I did want to address why people a year ago or so started moving out of the Middle East. And I think there's a couple of factors. The first is the fighting intensified within Syria, and the bombing and the killing got worse. And I think that that's, your average Syrian who flees Syria has moved within Syria a couple of times already. And I think they've exhausted their options. They then went mainly to Lebanon, Jordan, and Turkey. Those countries have taken in millions of refugees. Lebanon has 4 million people, and 1.25 million or something like that are Syrians. And it's as if we had 70 million Central Americans crossed into the United States. It's a huge, huge challenge. And those societies really are unable to take any more. And I think you have the kind of the overflow, that glass of water of the neighboring countries is full and is overflowing north into Europe. And then psychologically, people kind of have given up. I met a man on a bus in Greece, in Athens, a Syrian man who told me Syria is dead. And it was one of the saddest things I've ever heard. He felt that his country, he just had lost hope that he would ever be able to go back. And people had that hope and kept that hope alive for 5 years, 4 years, but they've lost hope.
It's kind of a grim note on which to take a break, but we do need to take a break. I want to ask you about that, Mark, when we get back, and more on the effect that the conflict in Syria is having on refugees, on host countries, and the families who remain in Syria. I know a lot of listeners are wondering what you can do to help, and I also want to talk about that when we get back. Have you done something that you felt was helpful? Share your experience. Send us an email to midday@wypr.org or call us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about how Syrians are faring as the conflict in Syria enters its sixth year. I'm speaking with Bill O'Keefe, Vice President of Government Relations and Advocacy for Catholic Relief Services, and Mark Ohanian, Director of Programs for International Orthodox Christian Charities. Do you or someone you know have firsthand experience of the Syrian crisis? Join the conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Mark Ohanian, before we move on, I do want to ask you, since you are from Lebanon, and as Bill just mentioned, it is hosting a huge number of Syrian refugees. What is that like for you, watching your home country?
Not just for Lebanon. I think if you take the entire region and what we're seeing with the conflict in Syria, it's very personal to see this level of hatred and destruction and war. The region has not seen anything like that before in its history. I mean, despite the Lebanese civil war that raged on for 17 years, when I grew up in that civil war, and I haven't seen the level of destruction and the killing that we're seeing today inside Syria. So it's hard. And the fact that, Lebanese and Syrians have been historically friendly nations. So it's, but there's a limit to, and Bill addressed that in his earlier comments, there's a limit to how much a host, small country like Lebanon, with a population of 4 million can absorb in terms of not just the number of refugees, but also the services and the obligations that come with it in terms of healthcare, education, and other services. And that's something that, you know, we're trying to do whatever we can as IOC, and I know as IOCC, and I know CRS as well. And we're working, for instance, with we're doing school programming with the public schools that are supporting the Syrian refugees who have access to those schools in Lebanon. In fact, 2 weeks ago, I visited one of those schools. We just started this program with the World Food Program, whereby we're providing school lunches for Syrian refugees and also Lebanese who are attending those public schools as part of their nutrition and to reinforce or support their nutrition and diet. Yes, it is a tremendous burden, and I think some work is being done. The international community, after the London conference, for instance, the donor conference, there was a good commitment of support to the host countries such as Lebanon and Jordan. Good level of commitment, but again, we want to actually see those translate into action, those pledges to turn into action.
And when will we know whether they are? How soon would that tend? Would you tend to get a clue? Both of you watch very closely donor commitments, and so is it time to get worried yet, or do you think this $10 billion may actually materialize?
I think if you count the $6 billion from the EU for Turkey, which probably I think could be a technical foul to use sports terms, you might get closer to the $10 billion, You know, most of these pledging conferences do not result in the kind of commitments. Pledges are for pledging, not for committing in the minds of...
See, here in public radio, people actually make good on
their
pledges.
I know.
We're very grateful to our listeners.
I'm a sustaining member, by
God
the way.
God bless you.
So, but yes, it's a concern, and I think that in some ways for a group like Catholic Relief Services, the bigger concern is there's been a lot of support for Syria since the refugees started coming to Europe. It's the rest of the world we now need to worry about, because Syria has taken some of the air out of the oxygen out of the air for Ethiopia, for South Sudan, for Central African Republic. So there's a broader context here of humanitarian need across the world.
So I was going to ask you about donor fatigue. You're saying there is some, but it's not yet in the Middle East. It is in some of the more long-standing crisis points in the world.
Well, I think people in the United States have been generally responsive. Our government's been responsive in terms of humanitarian need. More needs to be done, but I think the U.S. has really taken a leadership role. I think just to give a shout out to our Senator Mikulski, who's on the Appropriations Committee. She's been a leader in helping to ensure that the humanitarian accounts that benefit the Syrian crisis have been plussed up in the 2016 budget, federal budget we're now operating under. And that's a really important thing. But, you know, the real question will be when the war stops, there's going to need to be a massive rebuilding effort so people can go back, and that's going to take real resources. And I have a feeling that most governments in the world have not yet wrapped their heads around that, and that's something we need to be talking about now.
Hmm. Mark, I want to get back to schools and to kids who are still in Syria. I mean, what kind of trauma have they been through, and is that being addressed in some way?
In a modest way. First of all, schools in the majority of the areas where we are operating, again, with very limited resources, those who are away from direct fire, they are operating. These are public schools, Syrian schools. But we need to remember that there's no town and village in Syria, excuse me, that did not have double, triple, or quadruple their own population. So the infrastructure in those places, in those towns, are having a lot of difficulty in absorbing the newcomers, the displaced population from within Syria. So that puts tremendous strain. Of course, government in Syria today, it's near collapse. There are basic services being provided, but they don't meet the expectation of the people, which is why organizations like ourselves and the Red Crescent and others and the UN agencies are doing a lot of good work, but that needs to be sustained. But look, we've been speaking about this about the pledges and the donor fatigue and all of this, the great programming that we all are collectively doing, whether it's in Syria or in Lebanon or Jordan or elsewhere. We should keep in mind also this, you know, we also saw a lot of political clout and political effort being put in the deal between the EU and Turkey just recently. If we have put the same level of effort in trying to contain this crisis and end this crisis, right? And there's a good opportunity we have right now with the ceasefire or the cessation of hostility, to be more accurate, that we have in Syria today. That's an important window of opportunity for us to build on and try to end this conflict once and for all and contain it, not just contain it for a period of time, but end it once and for all. The reality is, as humanitarian organizations, be it IOCC or CRS or others, we can put all of our resources combined and we will not be able to meet all of the needs that exist, whether inside Syria or in the neighboring countries. So it's far beyond our capacity, response capacity with the situation that we're seeing today in the Middle East. So I think it's important that we put efforts, including especially by the United States, in trying to come to a resolution with the Syrian conflict, so that we can, as humanitarian organizations, do the work that we need to do and actually start making a difference on the ground, as opposed to just being reactive and providing the emergency support that we've been doing by and large so far.
That's Mark Ohanian of International Orthodox Christian Charities, IOCC, here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with me here is Bill O'Keefe of Catholic Relief Services. Both of them are familiar with the crisis, the refugee situation in and near Syria. As I said, I'm sure many of our listeners are wondering what they can do to help. And I want to pick up on your point. I want your thoughts about what people who are concerned can do. And in particular, do you see a role that U.S. citizens should be playing, focused not only on helping the displaced, but some pressure to end the conflict? What should we do?
It's a million-dollar question, no? I think Secretary Kerry will be in Moscow, I think, in a couple of days, and I think that's an important, it looks like it will be important conversations related around the cessation of hostilities and what the vision is for that and how that will be sustained. I'm not familiar with the conversations that they will have, but to me, I think it's important that all the major powers, especially the United States, including Russia and the other regional players, being the Turks, the Saudis, the Iranians, it's important that sides have to compromise. There's nothing will be done without compromise. So we need to be ready to do compromises if we are really intent about trying to put an end to this conflict. And I think we should. Time has come to do that as well. The international community cannot sustain with the level of humanitarian needs that are emerging. And I think we're doing whatever we can, but we shouldn't confuse humanitarian aid as a substitute for a political solution. And that's why all of our efforts, I think, should go towards ending this conflict.
Bill?
Thank you. Great, Mark. I think really spot on. I would just add that Secretary Kerry has really done yeoman's work to try to pull together a process. And I think what American citizens can do is to keep our government on task and make sure that we don't get distracted by other things. Then there's always new crises and new situations, and that we stay focused on trying to negotiate an end to this crisis that has an inclusive solution that protects religious and other minorities, and that leads to much less violence. We're never going to be able to resettle our way out of this. We're never going to be able to provide adequate relief. And it leads me just to one other quick problem that I wanted to highlight, or problem with some solutions, is just back on education. Your average Syrian child who's fled, they've already missed a couple of years of school.
More than a couple in some cases. This war's been going on for 5 years.
For 5 years, exactly. And they are suffering from trauma and the kinds of things that children going through war. And there's a lot of efforts, and CRS is certainly involved in this, in providing child-friendly spaces where children can come to terms with what they've experienced and try to emotionally move forward. And then efforts to help build classrooms, train teachers, provide curriculum, and help them integrate into the local school system. And you can imagine that's just extremely challenging if suddenly it's like a school district in Baltimore County suddenly has doubled the amount of kids in a year.
So and many of them don't speak the local language, and they have different customs and
a different
they're traumatized.
Curriculum. Exactly. Big, big challenge. And we're all trying to grapple with that and help. And I think for Americans looking for work to support, that's a really good place to start.
So, of course, it would be wonderful if the pressures on those who are negotiating a ceasefire actually result in an end to this conflict. While people pray for that, what can people do to help? What would each of you suggest?
Well,
and of course, we will link to your websites on the midday page at WYPR's websites for whatever suggestion is there. But I'd love to hear your thoughts on what you'd like people to walk away with.
Well, first, I you know, for those who pray, I would encourage them to do so. I think it's a very complicated situation, and there's great value in that. Second of all, supporting groups like Catholic Relief Services and International Orthodox Christian Charities that are doing good work on the ground is very important. And third, pressuring our government to continue to give more from a humanitarian perspective to address these long-term problems and to stay focused on negotiating a peaceful solution. I think those are really super important and critical things, steps that we can all take, in addition to just learning as much as possible so that we're better prepared as citizens to help our government to get ahead of these sorts of crises.
We have just a couple minutes left. Is there one thing that you think people don't understand about this situation, that Americans, one thought you'd like to leave with our listeners that maybe Americans don't tend to get?
You know, I've had the opportunity to be in war zones before, And I'll just say I have a sense intuitively, and I've gotten to see just what it might be like to flee this kind of situation. And so I just want, and our friend Jason, who called earlier, to understand we're talking about women and children who are fleeing violence. They're fleeing the same people that we as Americans are afraid of, the sort of extremist groups, violence. And that, to me, is what we need to keep in mind in order to have the kind of compassion that we need to really look at the situation the way it needs to be looked at.
Marco Henney, and I'll give you the last minute.
Just one quick thought on education. We shouldn't forget the indoctrination that's happening in territories inside Syria that is under the control of ISIS and the Nusra Front. The Islamic State. One wonders what kind of education they are receiving in those places and the danger that poses to our societies going forward in terms of terrorism and that skewed way of the teachings that are happening in those spaces. As far as, you know, the Syrian conflict is an extremely complicated conflict. It has become a proxy war. Multiple countries are involved in it. We shouldn't oversimplify it as far as who is to blame. And so I think we need to also focus on who is our enemy. What is it that we want to achieve? What is it that we want to fix when it comes to this conflict, and put the focus on our efforts on that, because we seem to be battling on multiple fronts when it comes to the Syrian crisis. And we need to keep the interests of the people in mind, the well-being of the people in mind. And I think the politicians so far, whether in the United States or Europe or Russia or elsewhere, we don't see that they have the best interests of the people, of the Syrian people in mind, where what seems to be prevailing is the interest and geopolitical interests. I think it's time to make compromises at this point.
Mark, thank you. Mark Ohanian, Director of Programs at International Orthodox Christian Charities, and Bill O'Keefe, Vice President of Government Relations and Advocacy at Catholic Relief Services. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to the Diz for supplying lunch today for Midday Guests. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. It features burgers, wings, steaks, jumbo crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner and serves breakfast on weekends on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. I'll speak with Bible scholar Bart Ehrman about human memory, its flaws and frailties, and what that means for the Gospels, which were not written until decades after Christ's death. That's tomorrow's Midday. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.